So the assignment this week was to look at, research, think about a couple characters. This doesn't look like my normal box, so we'll see if this is the right color of box. We'll see if these worked or not. Yeah, sort of. Athanasius and Constantine are the ones we're talking about. So, what do you know about Constantine? What did you learn this week, or did you know already? He was an emperor. All right. Yes, it wasn't that then that he named it that once he assumed power. So, yep. So the first, and we're going to, this is where some of the debate will be, I assume, Christian emperor. Okay. And I like the conversation, but I understand that the guys with the mics can't get to you fast enough. So we'll try to reinforce with sound as much as possible, but we'll have to roll it a little bit. So there is this marriage of church and state that happens with him. Yep.
I learned this week, and I didn't know this, that Diocletian, the emperor, had held him like a house arrest or whatever in the eastern province. So he experienced Christian persecution as a young man, not as a Christian. Mm-hmm. But he was very aware, and that was one of the things that motivated him to make life better for the Christian church.
Yep.
Was his experience with an emperor who was really hard on Christians.
He called for the Council of Nicaea, yes. Why did he do such a thing? So the Council of Nicaea, 325, is what's going to give us the Nicene Creed that we looked at a little bit last week. So 325, he calls for the Council for unity in the church. That was somewhat cynical, but...
It was straight out of my textbook.
You can get the sense that Christianity has now become a force to be reckoned with at some level, even if only by numbers. So that in order for you to rule an empire that has some kind of unity, one of the factors that must be a part of that is that the church isn't fighting itself. So whether he truly was interested in Christian unity for Christian unity's sake or for the peace of the empire, both of those could be argued to be legitimate concerns of the emperor. He calls for the Council of Nicaea.
I find this conversion story really interesting, too. Like, it almost sounds like something straight out of the Old Testament, right? Like, his army is facing the opposing army, and he sees this cross in the sky, and it says, "In this sign, conquer." And then that night, Jesus appears to him in a dream and says, "So use this sign, and you will have victory over your enemies." And sure enough, his enemy drowns in the river.
Yeah.
And he has this... what's that? Anyway, it's sort of an intriguing story. I mean, the truth of it remains to be seen, but I think I was reading it. I was like, that sounds sort of Old Testament-ish.
So 312, this is happening. He is emperor in the east, and there is an emperor, Maxentius or something like that, who's in the west, Roman area. And this is pretty much a struggle. We don't want regional emperors anymore, kind of a thing. So the people at the top of the food chain are saying. And so they meet at the Milvian Bridge. If you Google that, it is still standing to this day. And course, the only way to get across the Tiber River at that point was across this bridge. And the Roman forces are coming, and Constantine's forces are there, and Constantine's forces starts to get the upper hand, but because they're on the bridge, the Roman emperor's forces start to withdraw, and he is more or less trapped on the bridge and gets forced over the side. If you think of what a Roman soldier looked like at the time, it didn't take much at all for his armor to be more than he could bear treading water with. So as soon as he was over the side, his day was done, and he sank to the bottom of the river. So that's at the Milvian Bridge, 312. So. 313, Constantine's in power, in control, and he's going to issue the Edict of Toleration. Which is a huge step to the recognition of the church, but it isn't as big of a step as some start to think. So the Edict of Toleration simply says, you can't be persecuted just for being a Christian. If you remember several weeks ago, there were some emperors who you could, just because of the name, that was enough reason for you to be arrested and interrogated and in some instances even executed. The name itself. Well, with Constantine, his first thing, this is in 313, he issues the Edict of Toleration. A person cannot be arrested, persecuted, executed simply because they are by name Christian. That is the first step to the ending of persecution. Theodosius II, who's going to be around late 370s, early 380s, is actually the one that's going to make officially the Roman Empire Christian. So sometimes it's attributed to Constantine. He doesn't actually do it. His move is simply to say he more or less legitimizes Christianity as one of the recognized religions in the empire. And then Theodosius II, at the end of the 300s, is going to come along and say, actually, if you are going to be a part of this empire, you will be Christian. And that's where things really get ratcheted up. We'll get there in a moment. So, okay. What? He did. He actually saw him around the time of Nicaea. He referred to himself as the bishop of those outside the church. Like, who made you bishop of anything? That is how he justified his presence at the council. Is that he saw himself as the bishop of those outside the church. He was doing it. There seems to have been a personal something there. Whatever that was, it's hard to know for sure.
He was also the first emperor to appoint a clerical position. Is that right?
Yes.
Alexandria? Or somewhere. And so that's our first experience of political power saying, I also have jurisdiction over the church.
Yes. So that comes back to this. So Athanasius is the bishop of Alexandria. The bishop before him was Alexander of Alexandria. That's an easy one to remember. And Alexander, on his deathbed, they're wondering who should be the next bishop of Alexandria, and he says Athanasius. He says it three times, and of course, because he says it three times, and in his death throes, it has to be God's will. And so, even though he had not, there was, canonical law is a funny thing. We make rules up for, everything. Give us a couple seconds, we'll make a rule for or against it. But the canonical law is already starting to develop, and there's a rule that you can't actually be bishop prior to the age of 30. The feeling was that you hadn't lived long enough, gained enough wisdom to really be a wise person. But Athanasius is made bishop of Alexandria, having not reached the age of 30. So they're already breaking the rules. That kind of thing is going to be some of the reasoning that Constantine is going to use. So Athanasius ends up being a total thorn in Constantine's side. The question around this is, to what extent is he really standing up for Orthodox Christianity, and to what extent is he just a jerk? And there might be some of both, actually. 45 years he's bishop. 17 years of that 45 years he spends in exile. He was exiled from his episcopal see under four different Roman emperors. So you're either just really passionate or you can't play nice in the sandbox. I don't know what it is. Maybe a little both. But he's the one, the big one that's going to be fighting Arianism. And that is the major thing that happens at Nicaea, is settling this dispute. I can continue there. But other things that you know of either Athanasius or Constantine?
When we were in Israel, we heard about Constantine's mother, Helena, is it Helen or Helena? And she was fairly influential in finding relics or identifying sites. And then it was in her honor that Constantine built the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Yes.
Because she had found the cross, supposedly, or whatever. That was interesting to us, that a Roman emperor's mother would be significant to... I think there were perhaps two or three churches that we visited that her name was connected to. That was surprising.
There are some historians that question Constantine's Christianness. It's very difficult to question his mom's devotion to the faith. So there is that stream for sure. Yeah. And you know, while we point to these miraculous kind of epiphanies, like at the Milvian Bridge, you wonder how much mom's influence didn't actually play into this decision the whole way through. So, other things about that? Go ahead.
Something I read this week related to Sunday. Jim and I just had a conversation about Sunday. And if I'm recalling correctly, Constantine chose to have Sunday be the first day of the week because of the sun, not the Son of God, the sun in the sky. So there was some overlap of sun worship in his theology at some level.
Yes, that is a generally true statement. I'm not convinced of the first statement of that. One of the questions about his conversion has to do with the fact that why doesn't he get rid of the places where he personally was known to give devotion to the Roman gods? Prior to his conversion, he was a good Roman citizen. He had his own gods. He would do his thing there. I'm not sure how full the record is about him continuing worship practices there, but he certainly doesn't get rid of those places. So the part of the question is, well, why not? And had not someone kind of discipled him that this might be a good idea? I've heard things like that. I'm not sure that I'm just not convinced by the Sunday being about the sun. To me, that feels that we get all twisted up sometimes. The fact of the matter is, folks, yes, Christmas, when we celebrate it, was a pagan holiday. We baptized it. That is undeniable. But I don't think that should be a problem. If you think about the Northern Hemisphere, the winter solstice, December 21, which is actually pretty close to the 25th, the day in the northern hemisphere that has the least amount of sunlight all year. When else would you want to celebrate that at the darkest moment, the light comes? So the festival to the unconquered S-U-N does become the festival of the unconquered S-O-N. So I don't have a problem with taking the world stuff and saying, but Christ. And the other part of it is the church was already worshiping on Sunday. We know this from before 100 A.D., that we even read about some of it. They got up on the first day of the week, right? So they're doing their Jewish thing. They're observing the Sabbath, but they're gathering as Christians then on the next day, doing their Christian thing. They've added Christianity to their Judaism. Early on, it wasn't a one or the other thing. So the reason being was Sunday was the day Christ rose from the dead, and Sunday was the first day of the week. It was the first day of creation. There were all kinds of reasons to do this. So I've heard things like that, and there might be some strong reasons for it. That part of it, I'm not totally convinced. So, we can get your microphone if you want to.
I just wanted to, I guess as you look at it, it's very easy for us,
yep,
looking back, that we make judgments about all kinds of things about people from other eras, that we have no right to make a judgment about people from other eras. And certainly, he was trying to have peace. He was trying to... Like Jim said, the Nicaea was to bring unity. There's lots of different elements of what that unity might be, but we weren't living then.
Yeah.
So for us to say, well, why did he do that is a little bit...
Absolutely. And as we get... we're going to unpack this before we're done here today, some of the difficulties of the church-state connection. But let's be honest, folks. As Anabaptists, we're really big, especially in the academic end of Anabaptism, of saying the worst thing that ever happened to the church was Constantine. And this was the perversion of Christianity, more or less. It was downhill since the 300s. Well, that's nice, but it's kind of what Ed was getting at there. What person in the first three centuries, when you've been chased around the entire empire, fed to lions, sewn into the skins of animals so that the lions would eat you, set ablaze on the poles in Nero's gardens to light his garden parties in the evening, when those kind of things are what's regular practice, and now all of a sudden news has gotten out that the emperor has become a Christian and persecution just for the name has stopped overnight, who does not say, hallelujah, this is a movement of God? There's not a person that's going to say, you know, this is a really bad idea. We think we're going to opt for some more persecution. Thank you very much. This is an ugly thing most of the time. Someone is going to get pinched almost always. But there are other times where it's kind of like, it's mess, but it's hard to avoid. I mean, yeah, God can do what God wants to do, but if the German princes don't protect Luther, there is no Reformation. None. And they weren't just going to take him home and have a little talk. He was creating big waves. And so, yes, is this messy? Does it end up with someone often getting on the wrong side of the spear? Yeah, it does. And we have to be very careful. I think there's a lot of lessons for American Christians in this. But we can't, as Ed was saying, it's very easy for us to sit in judgment of past eras, epics, generations, and say, well, they shouldn't have. Give me a break. This was a miracle beyond miracles. The emperor himself is talking about Christianity. The emperor himself is calling the church together to talk. The emperor himself wants to be at that conversation. He has now put the cross on some of the shields of his men. do. It's the way it was. So, yes, good point.
So could you flesh out for me, because I was always a fan of Constantine until you put quotations around his Christian.
Yeah.
So what is it that you know, people have against him, and why do they doubt his Christianity?
One of the things is that he waits to his deathbed to get baptized. Now, part of that might be because not the only notion, but one of the notions that post-baptismal sin was unpardonable. So that could explain that. I think it's his great-nephew. So there are a couple murders.
The other emperor drowned, so he was maybe nervous.
There are a couple people very close in familial relations to Constantine who die, who are more or less executed, who, you know, those kind of things for a Christian emperor, not quite sure what to do with that. Now, here's where it gets interesting, though, that I think we on the Anabaptist side, another place where we have to kind of step up to the plate a little bit and do some deeper thinking. It's one thing for us to claim very sort of proudly our flag of pacifism. Okay? It's another thing to be a peacemaker when you're the one in power. The Anabaptists have never been the majority. During the Reformation, the Anabaptists were never in a place where they could have overthrown the Zwinglians or overthrown the Calvinists. They were never in number enough that they could have taken up arms. So I'm not saying they weren't devoutly peacemakers. I'm not saying that at all. Don't hear me ever say that. But it's also a little different to be a peacemaker when you have no power than it is to be the one with all the power and decide to say, I'm not going to exercise that. Could it be that Constantine truly was a Christian, hadn't grown in sanctification, understood fully what military was about and what the threats to his rule was about, and that's just how you dealt with it? That doesn't sit right with me, but it's possible. So some of the biggest things would be the waiting for his baptism. That's an issue. It's not a huge issue for me. The bigger question is some of the executions that occur in a preservation of his own position that clearly occur post-conversion.
One of the things about the executions, and I don't know the story there, but around that time, if somebody was executed for treason and something, his whole family went. Maybe, I don't know whether he just said, okay, you're the guy and the rest of the family, I'm going to leave alone. I don't know. But when we judge that, we judge it from our standpoint rather than of what was normal in that time of, you know, the world.
Yeah, it could well be that his exercise of that authority was more limited than we would have. It might be surprisingly limited, yeah, but it's a possibility. So who prior to this conversation would have said Constantine was a good guy? There's five of you. And the rest of you had him non-Christian to begin with, so that's all right. Okay. All right, so who knew that Constantine was a bad guy? And those who hadn't really cared or given it any thought prior to it. That's the majority. Okay. It's like the abstentions. And when the abstentions outnumber the other votes, I don't even know what you do. I don't have anything else planned besides Athanasius and Constantine today, so there is no other topic. So. Athanasius, his nickname by some, he was known as the Black Dwarf. The Black Dwarf, which was not a term of endearment. It was likely short, and he was from Alexandria, which is in northern Africa, so he is probably black.
I'm sorry, I was going to go back to your to the vote.
That's right.
No, I think
you'll change your vote. Or?
No, no. I think for me, I think it was helpful for you to say that about our historic Peace Church. You know, I grew up; generations have been in the Brethren in Christ Church. So for me, the very word Constantine sort of brought up all of these feelings about church and state, and about where we've come to this place in political systems and their entanglement with the church. So yeah, I think it's helpful, you know, to hear, for me to hear, for Jim. Jim did all the reading for both of us this week. You know, to hear about this, like the persecution. Of course this was a miracle that God provided for the church in a time in his place. So I think for me, yeah, I'm going to raise my hand and say I felt like he was a bad guy. Sorry. I mean, that's the way that historically I think our denomination has viewed him.
I think that's true. I think that's true of most Anabaptist denominations, yeah. Right, yes. And in that sense, at that point, that's where some of the blame for those folks would say the church should have resisted more. Absolutely. And part of it is, I think, we don't always think far enough down the road. If this, then what? Connected, a little different example is, all of a sudden, we go from predominantly house church format to pagan temples are donated to the church. We go from very little symbolism and formal liturgy to established ritual. And the priests in their garbs actually are starting to wear the garbs of the old priests of the pagan temples. On top of that, the priests, their salaries are being subsidized by the government. Now, you want to say, we didn't know we were saying yes to that. We were saying yes to no more persecution. We were saying thank you for, you know, getting off our backs, for allowing the gospel to go forth unhindered. We were some of us grateful that you were interested in Christian unity. But you paying the salaries of our priests, not sure what that was about. So sometimes it's an issue of, it's like the camel gets its nose in the tent. Once you're there, it's lost. If it wants to come in, the camel's in the tent. The issue here seems to be all the stuff that was wrapped up with it, that perhaps that part of it, the responsibility, does lie more at the church level. So,
curious, since neither of us, you know, we've only been Anabaptists for 9 years, we should know more, but anyway, what would the general view of the Brethren Church be on things like school prayer, not voluntary school prayer, but, you know, the way it used to be done, maybe over the, at commencement, or over the loudspeaker every morning at school. I'm just curious.
Had being a transplant and not a dyed-in-the-wool BIC, I'm not the best person to answer. My sense is that most Anabaptist denominations would not be in favor of compulsory anything that way. It is the use of temporal power in any form that ends up being what is most problematic about the relationship between the church and state holding hands. And so I, those of you who are lifers, I'm happy to be corrected or having that nuanced in some way.
It's awesome, I think, that the superintendent, you know, allows prayer to take place. But I think the compulsory is the issue. If we're mandating that everybody, because it's the rule at school, in public school, so we would not have been a proponent of that. We do that in church, and we do that in our home. And then our children are little lights in this place, but that wouldn't be. So, and the same thing with voting. You know, I think my parents and their generation really struggled with voting because, that's not a popular notion to not vote. I think I've struggled with that in my own life, feeling like making a good, conscientious decision about a political system is a difficult one for me. I think that was the way that I was raised. We think very carefully about our involvements with government. I know there have been issues with paying taxes for certain things, for the war machine and for other things that we have struggled with. So it's not a simple thing. And we can't, for many Brethren in Christ, you withdrew from the world for a while. You had your own little communities, and then it was easier. And maybe, I don't know for them, it was easier. They dressed a certain way, so they were identified as a certain group. And maybe as we're not anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Again, this is, the last part about the dress comes back to me is, this is one of those moments where kind of, you wonder, did we think this the whole way through? In that, I remember in Ashland, so the Amish are there in plain dress, but who are the people sticking out in the store? You might call that plain, but it's actually drawing attention to you. So it might end up actually having the reverse effect that you thought you were. Fine, they're not looking at you because you have snaps. Congratulations. But the fact that you came in looking like you do, everyone is looking at you. So it's not that the dress is bad. It's just sometimes that you wonder, did we think all of the implications or ramifications out sometimes?
As far as school prayer, you know, it sounds wonderful that prayer would be done in schools, except that if you get into a community that's mainly Muslim and the schools are the school board is Muslim and they want prayers coming from the Quran, that's another story too.
Yeah, it is an issue. It was, 10 years ago in Dearborn, Michigan, in the early fall, the football preseason for the high school football team was happening from midnight to 4 a.m., because it was falling over a Muslim holiday. So if you were a non-Muslim living there and wanted to play football, your preseason practices were from midnight to 4 a.m. Well, you know, we don't think about it always when it's other people and their religion. We would say never, but do we do that same kind of a thing? Is there another?
So...
waiting
for a little while. So actually, this is kind of interesting that I've been waiting for a little bit because some of the topics that I wanted to address have been a little bit alluded to, talking about the war machine, talking about Islam, talking about church and state. So how would you put in relation, so just to preface this, I'm skipping about 1,000 years and change here. So how would you put in relationship the church and state issuance here and how the pervasive power of, hey, let's just kill people because, well, God wills it, to the Crusades. And go.
What are you actually asking?
So the Crusades is known as basically saying, hey, God wills it, so you need to die. And protecting our motherland from invading armies, and how we used the office of God to say this is what God wills, with how the relationship with the country and the papacy, how they would come together and use that power to say this is what the church and state decrees. And so how was that, How is that different or in relation to kind of what Constantine was doing with his? I mean, obviously he wasn't saying, hey, God wills it. But, I mean, we definitely see the introduction of that idea coming from this area.
This kind of goes back to the earlier distinction. This is where I think to blame Constantine is an error. You can blame him for the direction that is set, but that's about all. When you get to Theodosius II, for example, and he decrees that the official religion of the empire is Christianity, that's where we've taken another step, because what has happened now, the church has this extreme temporal power. How is that? Because if you want to do business in the empire, you have to be a member of the church. Who gets to decide who's a member of the church? The church gets to decide who's a member of the church. That means we are essentially the distributors of business licenses. So if we don't feel that you're giving enough, if you've upset the wrong priest or bishop, we can deny your license to do business. By what? We just say you're not a member of the church. And the emperor said you've got to be a Christian to do business. So all of a sudden, what is like, they're kissing here, they've become intimate lovers by the time we get to Theodosius II, where we end up with this kind of weird relationship where the church does have and starts to exercise pretty profound temporal power. The problem with it is always, for me, we have lost the sense of the gospel being persuasive. We've not done a great job of helping people being persuaded by the gospel. We're interested in conquest and converts. And so that's part of it. Again, this is one of those things where it's easy to talk in big. The Crusades a black eye on the church? They are. But it's a much more complicated situation than that. They start because Islam has surrounded and laid siege to Constantinople. They are starving Christians. And the head of the church there has asked Rome for help. Now, he can say, we're praying for you. But if he has access to armies, he can leverage those armies. Am I happy that that happened? No. Did it lead to all kinds of other atrocities? Absolutely. But it's not like the Christians just got up and said, let's go kill Muslims, which is some of the ways stereotypically that the Crusades get talked about. You almost get that feeling sometimes. But we were just kind of rabid for war and needed someone to take it out on. So even the Crusades, I think, have to be understood more broadly than they typically are. Where this comes to us, I think, as Christians is, you know, the 1980s with the moral majority kind of movement. How much pressure should we be trying to exert on governmental structures? Do I think Christians ought to be a witness? Do I think Christians have a place in government? I do think all of those kind of things. But one of the lies of politics is you having the good life depends on me being in power. That's the message that politicians will tell you. Your candidate has to get in for things to go the way you want it to go. And the subtle message of all of politics is your person's got to be in power. And what that does, I think that sings a lullaby to us to sleep, where we misplace where our trust is then. My hope isn't in who sits in the White House, folks. My hope isn't on which party has the majority of people on the Supreme Court. My hope isn't on whether congressional districts are valid or not valid, constitutional or not constitutional. I'm not saying we shouldn't be concerned about those things, but at some level, all that stuff is a distraction to the one who makes kings and raises up kings and tears down kingdoms. And so it's when we rely too heavily on this. So right about the time, a little after Theodosius II, the church starts to talk about the donation of Constantine. And if you look that up, it's this document that was forged that makes the case that Constantine gave the church temporal authority and power. And they used that. They used that document and used it to grab hold of, that's how, to this day, the Vatican has an army. And it's not one that would really keep anyone out, but they have armed soldiers. So, was there a hand? No, okay.
I was just going to say something in response to what Sue said about having only been among pacifist denomination for 9 years. I never heard the word pacifism growing up. I never encountered it until I got to Messiah in 1976. And I am still trying to figure it out. So I assume I'll spend the rest of my life trying to figure it out and probably won't. So I wouldn't worry about only thinking about it for 9 years.
Part of it for me is the undeniable truth that Jesus told his followers that they ought to be lovers of peace and makers of peace. That, to me, that's an undeniable truth. The other part of it, though, that where the rub is, he had all kinds of opportunities to address the temporal powers and didn't do it. What are you supposed to do with that? Why didn't he say to the Roman centurion, I'm sorry, you're on the wrong side of the issue on this one, bud. I can't heal. That was a non-issue. You know, if you're really going to be one of my followers, you're going to have to put that soldier stuff away. That one. Sure, you have a need? Let's go. It is a complicated, complex thing. And I think our denomination felt that in World War II, where you had within the same family some saying, I can't do this, and some say, I have to do this. And it is. We're still scratching our head and trying to say, okay, what does this mean? So I think the undeniable reality is that Christ believes his followers ought to be peaceful people, lovers of peace and makers of peace. Now, what does that mean beyond interpersonal relationships? How does that get translated to organizational structures and businesses and institutions and countries?
Psalm 94, and this was just really interesting for me to think about. O Lord, the God who avenges, O God who avenges, shine forth. Rise up, O judge of the earth. Pay back to the proud what they deserve. How long will the wicked, O Lord, how long will the wicked be jubilant? And that whole psalm is about praying to God for the destruction of wicked. So we can pray to God for the destruction of ISIS, Boko Haram. You name them. And I think that's the part that the church should take.
Mm-hmm.
And if God chooses to use a temporal power to do the same thing, that's his decision.
Right.
It's not mine.
Yeah. I don't even know where we are anymore. So anything on any of that or these two characters? The two big things he's known for is his defense of what we now understand to be Orthodox Christianity, the traditional understandings of Christ as having two natures without confusion. The other thing is his understanding of bodily resurrection he was known for. Those were kind of the two big things that are going to be, he goes down in history for. Like I said, 45 years as bishop, 17 of those in captivity or in exile in some way. There's a book called from Peter Lighthart called Defending Constantine, in which he tries to, one of the things that he one of the points he raises is to, yes, Constantine may have tried to exert some influence on the church at Nicaea or through Nicaea. He said the fact that Athanasius is always raising up against him is an indicator of that Constantine didn't have total control of the church. I think that's an interesting point. But I think it's also, you can't deny the fact that they're in conflict, that is also evidence that Constantine is trying to influence the church. You don't go sending the bishop away somewhere if you're not trying to give sway on the church. But the fact that, I mean, he could have him killed. There are other ways he could have dealt with this, and he doesn't. So Peter Lighthart tries to make the case that because these two are in conflict over some of these issues, that it's a sign that he was limited in how much influence he tried to exert. I think that's probably true, but I think it's also true that's a sign that he was trying to influence the church in some way. I love Athanasius, one of my heroes. He also, though, when he gets in some of the heretics, so when he's dealing with the Arians and the ones who eventually become what's called the Donatists, Athanasius does, he is okay with temporal power being used to bring people into orthodoxy. So this isn't an issue of bad guy, good guy. This is a, well, okay. And, yeah, okay. It's not villain and hero stuff. Athanasius did not have a problem with temporal power being used to bring people into compliance and away from heresy. That's sad, I think, but it is what it is. You want to say something about it?
Can't speak too loud today. I was just thinking back over the years, I belong to a church, and when our presidential election was, and the president won, it happened to be the, I think his wife was the same religion as I was going. And it came down from up before, and now we've got somebody in the White House. And I think that this probably went along years after years. What would we think if a big person became governor or something like that? How would we react to things like that? Would we be glad and say, boy, now we can get something done?
That, I mean, those are the kind of questions that I think are valid for us to ask. What does it look like if the BIC do become the dominant denomination in the country, or do rise to some kind of prominence and influence over, if we're setting the agenda in some way, what would we maintain our same commitments? Would we be as willing to allow a plurality of voices being lifted up on certain issues? Not to go back there, but that is one of my concerns about the whole open theism issue, is the constricting that some want to occur. We're not talking about out there. We're just talking about the diversity of belief within this. It is not typically the BIC way to say, stand in line or we're coming after you. I guess get in line would have been a better way to say that. Stand in line too. Yeah, we have to be very careful of the marriage between church and state. It happens. It's messy. We want Christians in positions of power. I would rather have a Christian in the offices than non-Christians in the offices. But our hope is not in them sitting in those chairs. That our hope is in someplace else much more glorious and much more powerful, actually. So this just an interesting time in the church where we really tried to find our way. Some would say we stumbled. Some would say we fell flat on our face. Some would say, well, this was a blip. But it was kind of our first instance of trying to say, what do you do when all of a sudden you go from the doghouse to the penthouse? And that's really what it is. From chased around to given property, trying to gather up enough offering to keep your people going, to now the government is subsidizing what you're doing as a religion. It's very interesting. Maybe we got it right, maybe we didn't. All the more reason why I think it's important for us to be thoughtful Christians and say, okay, yes to that, but what if we say yes, does that mean this, 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 this? Well, I say yes, but I'm not sure I agree with all of that, so maybe I have to say no. And that requires some deep thinking on our part. Okay.